All right, we're going to bring on now Ralph San Antonio, who's got a fascinating story, Rockport resident, an aerospace engineer, who happens to know my buddy Gary Larrabee. And Ralph, first of all, welcome to MSO News Sports, and tell me,
Thank you. How
do you know Gary Larrabee?
Well, Gary wrote an article about Salem Country Club a few months ago, and actually it might have been 6 months ago. And in it he said that we had undergone a greens restoration project at Salem because of the 2017 U.S. Men's Senior Open that we're hosting. And that really wasn't the case. It actually came about because of the 2001 Senior Open, when Johnny Miller made a comment that our greens were round or elliptical, and that was very unusual for a Donald Ross course. So a lot of things happened, but many years later, I heard the comment and started doing some research and found some aerial photographs of Salem.
Now, there's a story behind that. Come on. How do you find these aerial photographs?
Well, I happened to Google those. They were satellite views, but you know I have experience with satellite photography. So I found that, and then I found a source in the Tufts archives, Donald Ross archives, that had the original drawings for Salem Country Club. And I put together a presentation for the members at Salem. And the Green Committee chair, John Shine, invited me in. I wasn't on the Green Committee at the time, to give the presentation at one of our member meetings. And I gave the presentation, and it started a buzz. Mm-hmm. And the board gave us approval to get some pricing for what it would take to put them back the way they were. Scope of work was way beyond what I had anticipated, and the members approved $550,000 for us to bring the greens back the way they were. I've been in touch with Johnny Miller and Johnny Miller's son to tell him about his comment and what his comment resulted in, and he was quite pleased. And we were blessed. We were blessed because last spring, we expanded our nursery to 10,000 square feet, and we used the plugs from aeration to grow the turf so that it would match the blend we have in the greens, poa and bent. And but we didn't expect to be able to use that for a year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it usually takes a year for turf to grow so that you can harvest it and use it. But we found that by the 1st of October, when we're about to start the project, that the turf was ready to go. And we were really fortunate in that regard. So the turf we used on the green expansions, which to bring them back to their original contours, is all Salem turf. And, you know, it blends right in with the greens that are there. You don't see where the expansions are.
So somewhere in the history of Salem Country Club, the original design of the greens had been modified and changed, and then now it's back to the original?
Exactly. And you could see, if you went to the original Donald Ross drawings and just drew an ellipse or a circle in the middle of what he had implemented, then you could see what happened. And it happened during World War II, when labor was scarce, and skilled labor was even scarcer. And so they just started cutting the greens in a circular fashion. And so all of the interesting edges of the greens, the protrusions, were lost. And, they turned into rough or collars. And so we brought all of that back. And we brought on an architect, Ron Force, who's done many Donald Ross restorations, mm-hmm. to lead the project. And a company called Country Golf from Traverse City, Michigan, to do the work. Jerry Diemer, who's done work for us before. And Jerry Diemer, replaced the turf at Fenway Park when they had problems at the Fenway, and it's been beautiful ever since. So Diemer and his crew started on the 6th of October, and they started in earnest on the 10th because we were still awaiting some parts for the sprinkler system. Mm-hmm. And they finished by the 20th of November, and that included restoring some bunkers that had disappeared over the years, restoring some back to their original configuration, expanding the approaches to the greens where they had come in over the years. And to redo the greens, we had to completely rip up the irrigation around the greens and replace it with a new loop and new risers and heads, because the greens had gotten smaller when they were cut in a circular fashion. And so the irrigation was designed to water the greens in their smaller version.
Right. Okay.
So we had to rip all that out,
wow,
put in new loops.
So the dominoes really fell.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why I said that the scope of work went way beyond what I imagined. And but the result is just gorgeous. The members are so pleased. We've restored some of the stone walls. We've gone in and cleared brush in between trees, between the holes. And the course looks absolutely fabulous. This is the best I've seen the course since I joined it in 1990. So
I can see Gary smiling as you describe this. And were you there at Media Day? Was on Monday for the Senior Open, which is in 2017. Were you there on Media Day?
No, I wasn't. I was at work
working
on Monday.
There.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get to the work part, if we could, Ralph, because your story is fascinating. I always in meeting you, I know that you are an Air Force Academy graduate, and let's go back to that. Where did you go to school? A little biography of yourself. Where you went to school in high school and then the Air Force Academy.
Well, sure. I went to high school in Warwick, Rhode Island. And my wife and I were both graduated from Warwick Veterans Memorial High School. Although I knew of her, we didn't date in high school or anything like that. And I went off to the Academy and spent 4 years at the Academy. I'd hoped to be a pilot. I wanted to be an astronaut at the time. I found out just before graduation that I couldn't go to pilot school. And so my academic advisor said, well, what are you going to do? I said I hadn't considered it. And he said, do you want to go to graduate school? And I said, sure. And so we decided the three best schools for astronautical engineering were MIT, Michigan, and UCLA. And I was fascinated with California after seeing The Graduate and other movies like that. So,
practical reasons.
Exactly. So I said I'd love to go to UCLA. So I ended up at UCLA, and where I got my master's degree in astronautical engineering. And it's been a lot of serendipity, because when I was there, a friend of mine who was taking courses with me told me about the work they did up at Sunnyvale, California. And I had put that in my dream sheet in the Air Force, which is your personnel folder, what you want to do with your career.
Okay.
So I put that down, and the next thing I knew, I had orders to go to Sunnyvale,
north
California.
North of Sunnyvale, is that Vandenberg?
No, Sunnyvale is north of Vandenberg, probably 75 miles north.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 50 miles south of San Francisco. So it's right in Silicon Valley. And it was just this, literally, a blue cube right off of Highway 101. And that's where all the computers were that we used to generate the messages that we sent up to the satellites. And I was originally assigned there to be on the Manned Orbiting Laboratory program, but that got canceled because the government decided they weren't going to use space for military reasons. So they say.
Your fingers crossed behind your back there. Okay.
So in any event, I ended up working on some fascinating programs. We launched a new satellite, class of satellites, that was wide area reconnaissance, and we used to photograph Russian missile launch facilities and submarine pens. And of course, all this was extremely classified back then.
Mm-hmm.
Could never talk about it. My wife and kids didn't know what I did
until
a couple of years ago when they declassified all of this. And they actually brought the satellite down to the Smithsonian for a while for people to see.
Is that right?
It was fascinating technology. We had reentry vehicles on the satellite, four reentry vehicles, and 60 miles of film. Enough to go from Boston to Providence. And the film was very wide, but it would roll into each of the reentry vehicles. We call them buckets.
Mm-hmm.
And it would pass through all four. And when it got to the last one, it would roll around a spool. And when that got full, we'd cut the film, and then it would start rolling around the third bucket. And we'd kick the reentry vehicle off into the atmosphere. It would burn in and deploy a parachute, and then a C-130 would go along and catch it midair, yeah, and then fly it to Washington, D.C. for the photo interpreters at the NRO to look at. Of course, NRO was highly classified back then, too.
What's NRO?
National Reconnaissance Organization. We were working for the CIA, basically. And
wait a minute, I'm looking around here. Okay, so don't scare me, man.
Okay. So, you know, like I said, it was fascinating stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, the first bucket, the C-130 missed the parachute, and the reentry vehicle fell to the bottom of the ocean floor, mm-hmm, and they sent the Navy Trieste down after it.
Trieste, really?
To recover it,
yeah,
and they did. And then they flew that one. I think they flew into New York where the contractor was to try to recover the film.
Wow.
So
did you witness launches and so on? Are you strictly in an office, or how did that work? What was the logistics for you?
We could see the booster going up,
okay,
from Sunnyvale.
Mm-hmm.
We launched them out of Vandenberg.
Right.
We would generate the pad load messages. So that's the message that you load in the satellite prior to ascent to put everything in a safe condition, and then turn everything on as soon as you get into orbit.
It's done by radio?
We could for Vandenberg. Actually, we could for all of the sites. We had about 9 sites around the globe. Some of them with the locations at the time were classified. There was one here up in New Hampshire that we used. But so we would generate a message. I ended up being the shift leader and then a shift supervisor, and we had 2 huge computer rooms. Probably each computer room was twice the size of this room.
And we're the Pleasant Street Tea Company. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
And with all kinds of tape drives and discs and computers and card readers. And so all of our work was done with card decks, and we would generate these messages that had all of the commands for the satellite to turn the transponders on when it got over a tracking station, turn them off when it left the tracking station, so that you could communicate with it. Yeah.
So you had to know computer logic. You had to know, I'm guessing, all kinds of engineering besides. Aerospace includes all of that?
Yeah. I mean, when I got my degree, I had to take overloads the entire 4 years that I was there.
Right.
Because you basically were getting a degree in EE, electrical engineering, mm-hmm, aeronautical engineering, chemistry, and astronautical engineering, plus mechanical engineering. So it was a very robust program, and it gave you a well-rounded engineering background.
Fantastic.
So
what was your rank? Were you? I imagine you were very young at the time.
Yeah, I was. When I first got to Sunnyvale, I was a second lieutenant. I made first lieutenant and then captain there. And at the time, I was part of the Vietnam buildup, so I was a captain for like 10 years, and that's why I decided to get out.
Right,
you know,
right. That, sort of, yeah, I remember that. Everybody got stuck where they were. Yeah,
exactly.
The thing that's fascinating to me, I know every time I would read in a paper, but and obviously I'm a space nut. I love space and flying and all of that, but every time we'd see a launch from Vandenberg that was in the paper, they talked about a weather satellite, and these were polar orbits and so on. But that you're smiling as I say that. These are the kinds of things that you were involved with, not weather satellites.
Yeah, absolutely. You see, our computer, we had to optimize the film. So we used the WAC chart, the World Aeronautical Charts, and which have WAC cells, small areas, and the targeteers, the people from the CIA and the photo interpreters, would assign values to each WAC cell in terms of high priority targets. And so we would run algorithms that would optimize the use of the film in our pass over the area of interest. And so our messages basically commanded the camera in terms of the angles, when to turn on, when to turn off. And we had, you mentioned weather, but weather was a factor. Mm-hmm. So we had a very classified connection to Global Weather Central in Offutt. And we had to bring in the weather in those WAC cells And then, you know, if there was going to be overcast skies in the area of interest, even if it was a high priority target, you know, the system wouldn't take that shot because it would be obscured by the clouds. So,
I'm sorry.
Yep. No, that's okay. So after all of this, then, you know, we generated those messages and sent them out to the sites that would be seeing the satellite when it came over.
So pardon me for using the term, but is there a lot of fly-by-wire? Can you tell exactly, you know, what's going on while these things are up there? You get messages back from the machine?
No, actually, that's what made it extremely interesting because, first of all, you did everything in terms of all of your planning and commanding based on where you thought you were going to be by projecting ahead what's called the ephemeris, which is the ellipse that the satellite is flying around the Earth. Now, we were in a near-Earth orbit, so we were between 90 and 100 miles up. So every now and then we had to include some burns to maintain the energy in the orbit so we didn't burn into the atmosphere.
Cool.
Yeah, so that's interesting for another point I'll cover in a minute. But I'm sorry, what was the original question?
Well, just about now with real-time, with digital stuff, you can get messages back from the spacecraft.
Right, so we only got messages back when we went over a station. So the station would then collect telemetry data from the satellite, and we could figure out exactly what the ephemeris was versus what we thought it was going to be.
Okay.
So then we'd have to run history programs and update history because we took photographs of a certain area, and you know, based on changes in the ephemeris, we didn't get exactly what we thought we were going to get. So history updated the target database so that the next time we ran messages, you know, it could account for the fact that certain things hadn't been looked at when, in fact, we thought previously that they were. So it was fascinating because there was this whole temporal aspect to it as well, you know, where things weren't what you thought they were going to be when you did what you did, and now you got to fix it. So very interesting.
Absolutely. I know people look and say, oh, we went to the moon. You look at the moon, you it's not like, you know, pointing a gun at it. You got to figure out where that thing's going to be down the road, the mechanics and so on. But very sophisticated stuff, Ralph, way back, I don't want to say way back, but when you began, did the technology increase at the rate it's increasing now while you were there?
Well, the technology we had at the time was like the state of the art.
And it was years ahead of what everybody else had.
Right, exactly, because we had a sister program that's also been declassified, and that was extremely high resolution. I don't think I can give numbers, but let me say that if someone using that system, if someone was hitting a golf ball out of a bunker, you could see the ball coming up. Okay.
Okay.
So, very, very granular. Yeah. And I actually saw that picture. So
okay.
It was probably taken around here on 128 near our station in New Hampshire. But, so it was... I don't know if they got into real time after I left, because you have to be cleared for the program, for the specific programs. And I had, my next assignment was back here at Hanscom Air Force Base. And so I no longer worked in that environment. It's really interesting. It was because of JFK that I had my appointment to the academy. And if JFK had not been assassinated, then Houston would have been in Boston.
That's right.
And so I would have stayed in the satellite business, but I didn't. So.
And that was primarily because of LBJ?
Exactly,
you know.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, he decided it was going to be in Texas. You know.
Have you been there? Have you been to NASA in Houston?
No, I've been to NASA in at Cape Canaveral, but not Houston. Yeah.
Well, I know one of my... desires when I was in high school was to become an astronautical engineer myself, and didn't make it that far. Ended up in math, but the degrees you have, how have you used those since then? Now I know that you're still in the business.
Well, the engineering background was useful for a lot of things, obviously, and when you're flying satellites, you're using a lot of IT, right? Now, the computer rooms that I spoke of, you know, if you have a an iPad now. There's more compute power in the iPad than we had in our and those systems. The satellite computer had 32K of memory. Right? So, I mean, we were dealing with basically bits, you know, at that level in commanding the satellite. But because I was on the IT side and using, it was really enterprise software. I talked about with you about enterprise resource planning, and it was the same sort of application, but it was for the vertical market was satellite mission control as opposed to manufacturing and distribution and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I get that's what I the direction I went was IT and large scale systems, software systems. That's what I did when I was at Hanscom. I worked on telecommunications systems and all kinds of avionics systems. And then after I got out, I ended up in the commercial side working on back office systems for manufacturing companies.
All right, we're going to end it here for now, but I hope we can resume this at some other point, Ralph, and get together again, do this again.
I'd love to.
All right, that is, the name San Antonio, you said it's Italian. That's an unusual name, though, is it not?
Yeah, actually, the name in Italian is Sant'Antonio, Santantonio.
Okay.
And actually, a couple of my uncles retained that name, but my father and some of his other brothers and sisters decided to drop the T to make it easier to pronounce.
Sure.
They didn't realize they were making it a Spanish name when they did that because, you know, San Antonio, Texas, mm-hmm. right? So that's how it became San Antonio. If I had my way, it would still be Sant'Antonio.
Thank you, Ralph.
Yeah.
That is Ralph San Antonio with MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore.